This is part one of a 2004 teaching by noted Christian psychotherapist, Dr. Archibald Hart. His topic, the effect of adrenaline, stress, and cortisol on your body and mind.
It is wonderful to be back again. A real, real privilege. And I mean that. My wife and I both love the Four Square Church. We have many friends. Have a daughter and a son-in-law who are Four Square. He, in fact, is ordained as a Four Square pastor, although he is sort of come to his senses now and prefers to be in business. but some of you will come to your senses before this session is over, I hope. A correction on that introduction. American Association of Christian Counselors now has 70,000 members. The discipline has just exploded in our evangelical churches. We know that we're in trouble. We know it. And through the American Association of Christian Counselors, we hope to bring a Christian understanding of these issues. And it's very exciting to be a part of that movement. I have now founded the International Association of Christian Counselors. Will be the umbrella organization under which the American Association will come. We have helped found associations in Australia, in Hong Kong, in Singapore, in South Africa, in various South American states, in Europe, in England. We have an association of Christian counselors there, one now starting up in Germany. I'll be going in January to Switzerland. We'll be setting up one there. And all around the world, we hope to be uniting Christians in one common endeavor, and that is to help people. At a time when it is becoming increasingly more difficult to survive. things I'll be talking about in a little while. Praying in different languages, that's wonderful, but it reminds me of a story from one of the All in the Family episodes of Archie Bunker. Maybe just because we share the same name, but I have a fascination with Archie Bunker and his stupidity and so on. But one day he's frustrated with Edith, his wife, and he says to her, Edith, I talk to you in English, and you listen in dingbat. And I sometimes think that God must get frustrated like that at us. You know, I talk to you in Spanish or English or Chinese or Strine, you know, wherever you are. I talk to you and you listen in dingbat. It's a great lesson, therefore, for all of us. Well, I have been given freedom to talk about whatever I want to talk about today. So that's wonderful. That's the sort of freedom I like. Because I do believe God leads and guides and directs. But the Lord has laid on several issues this morning. And I apologize if this is not going to be one sort of straight topic. I when I get together with a group such as you, when I think of the influence that's embodied in this ballroom today, the people that can be touched by you, I'm overwhelmed. And but at the same time, I feel sort of responsible. I've got to do something, because if I can touch your life, then think of all the others that can be touched as well. So I have several topics that I want to pull together, and it is, I would say, an extension of what I shared in the San Diego conference last year. As I remember it, memory's getting a little bit of a problem these days, but my recollection is that it was about an hour-long session I had with you then. And it's a little bit of an extension of that, maybe going into a little bit more depth on some of those issues, and reminds me that it was just a few days after the last San Diego conference that Scott Bauer had his aneurysm burst and passed away. And so that'll be indelibly locked in my mind, linking you all with that conference and that tragic experience thereafter. But it did remind me once again just how fragile we are, how very, very narrow are the limits and the boundaries and so on. And I want to pick up, as I recall, my time with you last time, I was speaking under the general umbrella of finishing well. Finishing well. And I believe that a determination to finish well will accomplish most God's purposes in your life. I believe that with all my heart. Not finishing well does not augur well for what God can do in your life. Recently, a very famous scientist by the name of Elizabeth Kubler-Ross passed away. I've known of her and of her work most of my professional life. She wrote a book, Death and Dying. She was the guru who helped us remove the fear of death, help people develop, organizations develop strategies to help people die. And the tragic story about her life was captured in a San Francisco Chronicle, by a San Francisco Chronicle religion writer, with the following words. Incapacitated by a series of strokes, Elizabeth Kubler-Ross sits in a cluttered corner of her home in the desert, smoking Dunhill cigarettes, watching television, and waiting to die. Kubler-Ross revolutionized the way Americans look at death and dying, but decades of work with the terminally ill had done little to ease her own transition into the great beyond. Her mood is feisty, but her German-accented voice is faint and tinged with bitterness. For 15 hours a day, she says, I sit in the same chair, totally dependent on someone else coming in here to make me a cup of tea, she says. It's neither living nor dying. It's stuck in the middle. My only regret is that for 40 years I spoke of a good God who helps people, who knows what you need, and how all you have to do is ask for it. Well, that's baloney. I want to tell the world that it's a bunch of bull. Don't believe a word of it. I can't wait till I die. A tragic end to a brilliant career. Didn't finish well. Not finishing well is a risk that every one of us takes. Someone has called it the Elijah syndrome from that portion in 1 Kings 19, where suddenly something happens and it seems like the world has come to an end. I told you last time that according to the research we've done at Fuller, about only one in four Christian leaders finish well. Or put it the other way, three out of four don't finish well. Something happens. A moral failure, disillusionment, get sidetracked, get shunted into a dead end, and on and on and on. So my passion in these last years of my own life is to finish well myself. I wake up every morning and say, Lord, help me to finish well. Because the nearer you get to the end of the journey, the more you are targeted by Satan. The more you become at risk. It doesn't get safer. Toward the end of the race, it becomes more risky. Now, the part of, if not the major factor in not finishing well, is to get your priorities all wrong. So I want to talk for a little bit about your priorities. Then I want to move into some of the critical risk factors and give some practical advice, help in how some of those risk factors can be avoided and overcome. Just as a general comment, Dennis is an old friend of mine. I think I probably know you longer than anyone else in this room. But Dennis and I were talking about a friend we have by the name of Reggie McNeil. I don't know how many of you are familiar with his name, but watch Reggie McNeil. He is taking off in influence. Kath and I met him, 15, 18 years ago in South Carolina, Southern Baptist. He heads up the leadership training in South Carolina for the Southern Baptist. But when I did my first weekend seminar for the pastors of South Carolina, I was very, very impressed at the healthiness of those pastors. I can't say that I feel that way often when I do pastors' conferences. I can't say that. But I got, after this weekend with these pastors, I got this impression here were a bunch of people who had their priorities straight. It was very, very impressive. And we have continued every second or third year we go and do a conference for Reggie. I then introduced Reggie to our Doctor of Ministry program, and he now teaches for us. But he has sort of exploded out of the Southern Baptist box, is now on the stage nationally. And his recent book is a book called The Present Future, which is an intriguing title. But the basic message is the church cannot go into the future in its condition that it is in the present. That's essentially the message. Something's got to change. It cannot be business as usual. And we're deluding ourselves if we think that the church in its present form can move forward to into the future with effectiveness. It's a very, very good book, and I commend it to you. But the primary aspect of all of this that I want to focus on is to remind you that you are a person before you are a pastor. And as the supervisors of this wonderful denomination and the many, many who look to you for mentoring and direction and so forth, this is a message that has got to get out, because if you don't understand that, the priorities are all wrong. You're off to the wrongs. You've started on the wrong foot. You're a person before you're a pastor. You see, the problem with evangelicalism today is that we are all preoccupied with doing some great thing for God. But the problem is that God is preoccupied with doing some great work in us. And the reason for the shift, there are many of them, not the least of which I think has been the church growth movement, which is wonderful as it has been. But it has tended to put the focus on God doing that, on us doing that great thing for God. And many who don't finish well, because that is subtly, unconsciously, without realizing it, that is what has established their priorities. The reprioritizing towards making God's work in you as the primary focus of your ministry. It comes very clearly out of 2 Corinthians chapter 1. I believe in Scripture. I believe that God anticipated all the quirks and problems and everything else that we'd got into. But in 2 Corinthians chapter 1, in the first six chapters of 2 Corinthians, I don't know how many of you remember this, but I mentioned last time in San Diego, is in fact the portion of Scripture where the Apostle Paul sets out his theology of ministry. You'll find it here in these first six chapters of 2 Corinthians, sort of packaged together, succinctly, systematically, and this is where he brings together his thoughts about the theology of ministry, what it means to be a minister of the gospel of Jesus Christ. Praise be to the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, he writes, the Father of compassion, the God of all comfort, who comforts us in all our troubles so that we can comfort those in any trouble with the comfort we ourselves have received from God. Do you get it? For just as the sufferings of Christ flow over into our lives, so also through Christ our comfort overflows. It's overflowing comfort. That is the principle upon which all Christian ministry is based. If what you're doing doesn't impact your life first, it is of no value in God's kingdom. And there are scores, including mega church leaders, who are standing on the sideline wanting everyone else to play the game, but are not a part of it themselves. And that is why success brings with it the hazards it does, even if that success is success in God's name. God is not in the success business. He's in the refining business. You don't get that right, you don't finish well. And the more success you achieve, the greater risk you are that something's going to trip you up before it's over. On the one hand. And on the other hand, the less you achieve success, the more you run the risk of becoming despondent, depressed, downcast, and all of that. So we've got both these extremes. Those highly successful, at risk for not finishing well. Those no success, risk for not finishing well. And the rest of us in the middle there somewhere better watch out also, because it's still a narrow road that we all walk. It's an overflowing comfort business we are in. And with that priority, then we can begin to think about getting it straight. Another priority here that can get in the way is this idea that we must strategize for our success. I believe in planning. I believe in, you know, breaking down tasks, partializing tasks, making sure I do this first, that. I am a very efficient person. I think my wife would agree with me. I'm a very effective person. I can accomplish a lot. But the usefulness of my life, or its effectiveness, or whether or not I'm successful, is not my concern. It is God's. The usefulness of my life is His concern, not mine. All I do is go along for the ride. It is not our responsibility to make sense of our ministry, and it certainly is indecent for us to be worrying about it. My effectiveness flows out of my being faithful to His calling. When He says, go here, I go there. Well, but how does it fit into your great and grand and glorious scheme of things? I'm raising this issue because unintentionally, quite subtly, the business model has taken over our ministry. And in business, you strategize, you plan. We know that there's certain economic laws operate so that if we do our market research here, we can determine how many items of such and such a product we can sell in that area. And, you know, by and large, those laws are predictable and manageable, and so we can strategize and we can organize. But if I've learnt anything from my long life, is that you cannot strategize God. And the problem is that too often we think that nothing is happening and then go meddle with it. When in fact, when nothing is happening, a great deal may be happening. Because that is how God works. All right. So I want to bring us back for the time we have together this morning to focus on us, ourselves, our person. And I want to begin by giving you a little test. So if you have pencil and paper there, you may want to just sort of hide it so no one can see your answer, you know, and just give yourself a one. give yourself a one. There are 10 questions, and you get 1 point for each one you answer in the affirmative. If you say yes, give yourself a point on this one. It's a little test of boundaries. So one of the most important things we have to do, if my person is the key tool that God uses in his service, and it is. I don't know why. I don't understand it. Why does he reach down to the crummiest of his creatures? Because, you know, we'd like to think of humans being the sort of the glorious consequence of his creation. And in a sense, we are. But coming along with that gloriousness comes a complexity. And we are the only members of God's creation who sin. Ever thought about that? My point I'm making is that God reaches down. I create you to be the highest of all creatures. But I also give you the capacity to sin. And it's us that he has chosen to be his vehicle, his vessel. We are the vessels that transform it. And for that reason, if I am his tool, his primary tool, then who I am, what I am, what I do becomes crucial, becomes critical. So here's a little test, 10 items of called self-differentiation or boundary setting. To what extent are you differentiated from your work and your church? Differentiated. I don't mean separated. I don't mean, you know, totally ignoring it. But to what extent are there clear boundaries so that there is a boundary that says, you know, this is me now. Because if you don't have boundaries, you don't have a family. So you win a church and you lose a family. If you don't have boundaries, you're going to have all the stress. Unimaginable that is possible. You've got to have boundaries. So here's the 10 tests for self-differentiation. Number one, I plan at least one 24-hour period per week for myself. When I do not answer the phone, pager, or anything else, or do any church-related work. Okay? Only if you can answer that yes, truthfully, give yourself a one. One 24-hour period per week. Yeah, okay, I move to the next one.
This is also an ethical test.
It's a test of ethics, because you come up with a score of 10, and I'll know you're lying, and in my book, lying is sin.
That's the sinner part.
Get off my bed. I do not have people. Number two. I have at least one very close friend outside my church. One close friend who is not a Christian. And one group outside my church that I can meet with once a month for friendship, hobby, sharing, or whatever. We've got to step out of this box a little bit. We've got to know the world out there. You may be a tremendous influence to this non-Christian friend or group, but the goal is not to evangelize them, because the moment that becomes your goal, then it loses its function. See? All right, that's number two. All right, number three. I take all my vacation time and enjoy it and wish I had even more. Anything not clear about that one? Number four. I have at least one lifetime interest outside the church. For example, sailing, singing, golf, woodworking, baseball, collecting, hobbies, basically. I have at least one lifetime interest outside the church that I enjoy and can experience at least once a week. You see, once a year on your vacation, when you rent one of those surf sailing things, you know, doesn't count. It has to be I am a psychophysiologist, mainly a neuropsychophysiologist. I study the brain, its mechanisms, and so on. And I can tell you that this all makes sense neurologically. Because when you make these sorts of connections outside of your primary focus, none of this detracts from your primary focus. What it enables is some respite. This is a relief that mobilizes you back into your primary calling. It's the taking time out to sharpen the axe so that you can cut trees better. This is self-care would be another phrase that we would use to describe this. And self-care is a spiritual discipline. It's a spiritual discipline. All right, number five. My spouse and children have my complete attention when I am with them. All the wives are grinning and smiling and laughing and chuckling. I gotcha. My spouse and children have my complete attention when I am with them. You see, this is part of the problem. We are there physically, but we are not there emotionally. Yeah. And you know, the best person to ask to answer this question is your family. Sixthly, I take a day off every week and I don't think about the church at all. Any more? I have a bit there. Two? Any more for three? Three? But I take a day off every week and I don't think about the church at all. Number seven. I have a prayer group or Bible study group outside my church that I meet with at least once a month. Now that could be met by the support group notion. You've got to get out of your box. It's what keeps you sane. It's what restores your perspective. What makes you thankful. If all you get is that negativity, that criticism, that everything that's in that box, slowly it erodes your confidence. Slowly it eats away at your soul. And you'll pay for it. Eight. I am currently involved in learning, that is, reading, attending a class, researching on the internet, studying. I am currently involved in a learning experience about something that has nothing to do with the church.
Oh,
See, the problem is that it's what I call faceting. I am always impressed when I meet a Christian leader who knows what's going on in the business world, who knows what's going on in the scientific world, we've got to expand our horizons. Because that then enriches our ability to ministry. We've got people in our congregation in different vocations, in different spheres of living, and to be effective in that ministry, the more faceted you are, I call it faceting. If you look at a diamond, what gives it its brilliance is it has lots of windows. It's been polished. One of my hobbies is goldsmithing. And I built me a faceting machine. I faceted amethysts. And you take a dull thing and you put these faces on, all in a design that turns it into a series of windows and mirrors. The light goes in, bounces all around, and it comes out as that sparkling brilliance. And I think that there is a tendency for pastors not to be very well faceted. Not well faceted. And therefore, what goes into their sermons, into their teaching, into their relationships, into their ministering to the needs of others is a very limited repertoire of information. I believe this strongly because I am a great admirer of Charles Haddon Spurgeon. Charles Spurgeon, the famous Baptist preacher of the mid-1800s, founded Spurgeon's College in London. And there's been a resurgence of interest in Spurgeon in recent years. And there's a company back in Phoenix who have brought his books out, republished them. And the more I read Spurgeon, I tend not to read so much recent authors. I tend to go back a century or two and read some of the older folks. And Spurgeon was the one who preached this loud and clear in his seminary, in his training of pastors. That you have to be enriched. You have to have this larger. It shapes your perspective. It shapes your expertise, your influence, your power. And my wife will confirm. I am an avid learner. I want to know about astronomy. I want to know. Not a lot. I don't need to know a lot. But enough so that I'm knowledgeable about that area. I keep up in science. I know a lot about cardiology and different medical disciplines because that helps me in my profession. I'm fascinated with the brain. You know, it doesn't matter what it is. The principle here is one of being well-faceted. And that keeps your perspective in a way, and something I'll talk about later, it facilitates what is called resiliency, the ability to bounce back when things are down, when nothing is working in your immediate sphere of influence and work, right? This larger perspective helps you pull back and see, you know what, there's a whole nother world out there. There's a whole nother thing out there. Then we are at number 9. I let the answering machine pick up messages during meal times, meditation times, and family times. Turn on the answering machine. But make sure you educate your congregation on this. I doubt if any member of your church protests because you turn on the answering machine when you're home with your family having your meals. It's better they resign and go somewhere else. If they can't understand that. The telephone is a satanic device. The cell phone, too. Also. And lastly, I am not working more hours per week than I agreed to work in my contract. Someone said, "What contract?" All right, well, the score. If you 8 to 10, you're lying. Six to seven, your boundaries are weak. Work at getting a life, okay? 4 to 5, boundaries are too porous. Personal church trauma could put you over the edge. Act quickly. Get some boundaries established. 1 to 3, score 1 to 3, serious boundary difficulties. You need professional help is what you need. Okay, but I want to get back to and segue, because time is going on, into some stress management issues now. Because, I made the comment about the Apostle Paul time. You've got to get a very important neurological principle locked away in your mind. It is this: that the human brain in this age of ours today is being pushed outside the boundary of God's design. And I'm speaking as a neuropsychologist. I research. This is my area of research. We are living outside the boundary of God's design. Our brain's function is outside God's design. And several bits of evidence support that, this idea. Number one, the adrenal gland, two adrenal glands above each kidneys, which are the primary emergency response factories for the hormones, the stress hormones, called glucocorticoids. These hormones that help us survive in times of challenge, demand, push, and so on. That the adrenal gland is slowly enlarging. If you have depression, the adrenal gland will be enlarged in 50% of you. The adrenal gland is enlarged. In any stress disorder, the adrenal gland gets larger. In the late 50s, researchers looked at men who had died of heart attacks. This is before these days we get to you before you die of a heart attack. I was a year and a half ago now. I had my my bypass surgery, called the Zipper Club at Fuller. Now belong to the Zipper Club. But they studied men who had died of a heart attack and discovered that in almost every instance, the adrenal glands were enlarged. What is happening here is that the body, this wonderful creation of God, is adapting itself to higher levels of demand. And to do that, the adrenal gland has to get bigger. But in enlarging the adrenal gland, that is not good news that I have more adrenaline now to deal with more of a crisis. That's not good news, because the more adrenaline I have, the more cousin of adrenaline I also have. And the cousin of adrenaline is called cortisol. And cortisol, the cortisol is very damaging to the brain. In New Testament times, when the Apostle Paul did his ministry, there was built into his lifestyle sufficient recovery time for his body and his mind, his brain, to be within the boundary of God's design. No electric light, lamps, candles. Have you any idea how sleepy you get when the only light you have at night is a candle or a lamp? With the onset of darkness, melatonin level rises, the whole sleep cycle kicks in. You follow, you get into a dozy state for the first hour or two sitting around a fire or a lamp, but you're already into your sleep cycle then. So that is the most important principle to grasp, that we are not in a position where there is naturally built into our lifestyle the recovery we need to restore our system. I'm going to say something about cortisol for a moment. Cortisol is the big culprit now. Just the last few years, we've realized that it's all about cortisol. Cortisol and adrenaline are cousins. So if you have a demand, a deadline, a rush, an emergency, your adrenaline goes up, but so does your cortisol. Now, if you're a type A personality, are you familiar with the type A personality? Always in a hurry, you know, finishes your sentences for you. Standing in the supermarket, you know, in the express line. Express lines are for type A people. They give you a little red basket that tags you, type A. And then they usually take, type B is very slow, sort of sluggish, I think. Now, the supermarket managers know the difference between type A and type B. They take the type A checkout clerk and put them on the regular line and the type B on the express line. Just to frustrate us, type A's trying to get out of there. And you stand in line. First thing you do is you count the number of items in everybody else's basket. Yeah, this is type A, you see. Now, listen to this. Type A's produce 4 times more adrenaline than type B, but 43 times more cortisol than type B's. Massive amounts of cortisol. And cortisol has 3 serious effects in the brain. The first effect is it blocks the brain's natural tranquilizers. And hence, anxiety goes up. Second effect of cortisol, the first is it blocks natural tranquilizers. So that accounts for a rise in anxiety. The second thing it does, it blocks our neurotransmitters responsible for us, for our happiness, for being content, so that we get depression. So cortisol blocks out our neurotransmitters, so we get depression. And the third serious effect of cortisol, and this is only starting to be understood very recently, is that it causes one part of the brain to shrink, called the hippocampus. Just think hippopotamus. Hippocampus. It causes it to shrink. And with high cortisol levels, the hippocampus shrinks. And this effect is very, very amazing, because this part of the brain is now known to be the part of the brain that generates the brain cells for the rest of the brain to rejuvenate. It's called neurogenesis. Genesis, beginnings? Neurogenesis comes from this part, the hippocampus. Cortisol, stress cortisol, shrinks that. So what happens now is that fewer cells, brain cells, are being generated to go to the rest of the brain, which need it for things like memory, for example. And this shrinkage deprives the brain of that. And more importantly, disturbs the sleep cycle. So we're in a bind now in that we have A, extended the day so as to reduce the sleep time, and high cortisol levels under stress is messing with the sleep cycle, so now we can't get to sleep. So we have shorter time for sleeping and we can't get to sleep, and that is a catch-22. The ignorance relating to sleep is probably the most serious issue in stress management today. So I'm going to take just a few minutes to share with you some critical points in this domain. There's other stuff we could talk about in stress management, and I'm not quite sure exactly what we're going to do in the next session, but we'll break at 10. And then I believe we're going to separate. And after that, I might, depending where you want to go, what I'm saying is after that is basically where you would like me to go. But I want to share some thoughts about sleep before I finish this session, because it is the most critical issue facing us in ministry today, in our congregation, in our people. It's a significant contributor to the high incidence of depression in teenagers. They're just not getting enough sleep. And it is God's provision for us on a daily basis. How can you ignore it? I'm reminded of those words from 2 Corinthians chapter 4, verse 16. Therefore, we do not lose heart, though outwardly we are wasting away, yet inwardly we are being renewed year by year. Month by month? Day by day. So we fix our eyes not on what is seen, but what is unseen. For what is seen is temporary. What is unseen is eternal. But it's the day-by-day principle. Paul is absolutely right. We renew day by day. I can't wait for my annual vacation to rebuild my resources, to rebuild my brain, to rebuild my memory circuits and all the rest of it. It has to be done on a day-by-day basis. Now, I talked about that hippocampal shrinkage. It's reversible. It's reversible. Adrenaline enlargement is not reversible. You get more adrenaline going, you're at greater risk for cardiovascular disease, you're at greater risk for depression, and all the other consequences of excessive cortisol. But the shrinkage of the hippocampus is reversible. And the critical factor is how you manage your sleep cycle. Above everything else, this is number one. So let's just go through some important principles here in sleep. Number one, how much sleep do we need? It's very clear, very clear. The minimum sleep need for a healthy adult is 9 hours a night. 9 hours. The official from the Commission on Sleep is 8.5 hours. But that was a committee that voted. Because 8.5 hours does not make sense neurologically. We sleep in 1.5 hour blocks. 1.5 hour blocks. Each 1.5 hour block is a sleep cycle. You have to complete the cycle. Otherwise, you don't get credit for it. I mean this seriously. I wake up in the early hours, like this morning, we had to set the alarm for an early rise to come down here. And then I woke up at a certain point, and I do a quick calculation. I don't have 1.5 hours left before the next cycle is completed. I might as well get up right there and then, because I have to complete the cycle. Now, what completes the cycle is the dream stage of sleep, which comes right at the end of the 90 minutes. Dream cycle. It's got to be 1.5. It's 1.5 hours. That's the natural. We wake up every 1.5 hours. Most of us just turn over, go back, straight back to sleep again. But if you wake up in the early hours of the morning, just do a quick calculation. I went to bed at 11 o'clock. It's, 1.5. So it's 1.5, 3, 4.5, 6, 7.5, 9. And very common, 3.5 hours after you go to bed, that'll be like 2:30, 3 o'clock in the morning, you wake up. That's when you wake up enough to notice you've woken up. But now, it's 1.5 hours. And the problem is that God has put the dream stage of sleep that at the end of the 90 minutes. Before that is non-dream sleep is needed for physical rejuvenation. Right? Last day, I moved bricks. Our neighbor has sold a home, and we've got those garden wall bricks. We bought the whole pile, and I've been wheelbarrowing back. I was really physically tired last night when I went to bed, and I fell asleep, and I slept through the whole night without waking. Wonderful feeling. But you see, I was physically exhausted. So one of the important ingredients in good sleep is enough physical exercise to fatigue your body, because the first part of the dream cycle is for physical rejuvenation. And if you haven't fatigued the body enough, the body has great difficulty staying asleep because it says it don't need it anymore. But then comes the little bit of dream sleep at the end of it. 3 or 4 minutes the first cycle. The next cycle, it goes up to 8 or 10 minutes. The next cycle after that goes maybe to 15, 20 minutes. The last, if you sleep 9 hours, the last dream cycle, you're getting almost 35, 40 minutes of dream sleep. Now, it's dream sleep that's the problem for us, because dream sleep, whereas non-dream sleep is to rejuvenate the body, dream sleep rejuvenates the brain, the mind. You all use computers, most of you. There's a program called defragmentation, defrag. If you, every now and again, if your computer starts to slow down, what you're supposed to do is then go to your hard drive and click on defragmentation. Because you see, what's happened is the hard drive's been used and used and used and used, and you've got memory here and there, and there's this stuff wasted there. You've got temporary files here that could be cleaned up. You know the idea. And you clean that all up, and then you take the stuff that has to be kept, and you consolidate that memory all into one block so the computer now can speed up to access that memory. That is a perfect analogy of how God has designed the brain. The brain needs a defrag period on a daily basis, because the human brain is a phenomenal computer, enormously big by computer standards. But just one day's activities, the memories that we collect, the activities that we engage in, just one day's activities is enough to begin to slow down that brain, and it needs the defrag. If I deprive you of 3 nights of dream sleep, you can have all the other sleep in the world, but we can put electrodes on the brain in my lab, and we can tell the moment you're starting to dream. If we then interrupt your dream, so you get all the other sleep in the world you need, but you don't get enough dream sleep, you go psychotic, schizophrenic-like. You hallucinate. 3 nights. And your brain is in trouble. So what happens is the brain will force sleep on you. And I noticed when I was in Australia recently, there were big signs over the freeways about warning people about something called microsleeps. So when you're underslept, what happens is that you sleep sitting here listening to me. And the reason you listen in dingbat is because you've got a microsleep going there. You fell asleep for 10 seconds. Your eyes were wide awake. You're looking at me. You're smiling at me. But it's all gone. The whole significance of dream sleep has awakened recently. And that is what you need if you use your brain. We don't do as much physical work. We do mental work. And the more mental work you do, the more you need that defrag, the more you need dream sleep. And the problem is the dream sleep's at the bottom of the bottle. You've got to drink the rest of it to get to it. So to get enough dream sleep, you've got to have enough cycles that will get you to 9 hours of sleep. Follow? That's what I think it's 6 cycles. If you set an alarm clock, and we do that, I do it myself, just so that to back up in case I don't wake up in time. If the alarm clock goes off during the last dream cycle, the rest of your day is shot. Just observe it. Your brain is fuzzy. You can't think clearly. It's the day you feel weird. Because you have interrupted. It's like turning off your computer right in the middle of the defrag program. Have you any idea what a mess that makes of your computer? Because it's memory consolidation. It's resolving of conflicts. And it's the biochemical resetting, rejuvenation of brain cells. All takes during sleep. During the dream sleep. Sleep as a whole, all of sleep, is when your immune system is mainly active. Your body fights its disease while you're sleeping. That's why if you don't get enough sleep, you'll get sick. Your illness will get worse. That's why the body will force you to get more sleep when you're sick, because that's only when your immune system. There are all sorts of reasons to support this. All right. Time is gone, huh? But all right, let me just mention and then we'll take our break. The critical principles for good sleep management. Number one, always go to bed at the same time every night. Always go to bed. So if your schedule is that some nights you have late nights, adjust your sleep cycle so it's always the same. That's important because the brain has three clocks. And one of them, the critical one, is set by the time you go to sleep. So if you go to sleep one night differently to the next night, that clock is just utterly confused, doesn't know what's going on. You will then get insomnia and all sorts of other sleeping disorders develop. Yes?
Do you have any suggestions for pastors who stay up late Sunday night because they can't relax?
Yes, you've got too much adrenaline going. It's all covered in my book, Adrenaline and Stress. Yeah, you've got to get that adrenaline down. Learn a relaxation exercise. If you want a good CD, relaxation CD, I have a CD on relaxation and Christian meditation that I encourage everyone to master. A good relaxation exercise helps to lower your adrenaline. Just go to my website and you'll see how to order it, www.archibaldhart.com. My other books are there as well. You have too much adrenaline going. You've got an adrenaline charge up, and you've got to bring that down. So go to bed every night at the same time, and try to wake up every morning at the same time. Second important principle: darken your environment as early as possible in the evening. After it gets darkish, you need an hour or two before you can go to sleep. My wife and I turn off all our lights. We have a few little wall lights where we can walk around and find our way around, but we darken our environment. That helps you to get sleepy, sleep onset easier. Third thing, beware the use of sleep medications, even the over-the-counter ones. They are not sleep enhancers. They are anesthetics. If I know anything about an anesthetic, it's not sleep. You're zonked out, but it's not. The sleep cycle, the defragmentation, all that stuff that's got to happen, you don't get that from a sleeping pill. All you get is physical relief. You get your physical rejuvenation, but you don't get the defrag from sleep. Fourthly, avoid caffeine like the plague. Certainly, no caffeine after about 3 o'clock in the afternoon. Listen, folks, caffeine, I can tell you that I know no. I'm board certified psychopharmacology. I know this stuff. Caffeine is a poison. The opium dens that are now rampant around our society, they call them Starbucks. Why do you think they are making a fortune? Because they are selling you a drug. And it amazes me. I have this strong, I can't take an antidepressant. You know, that's a drug. And the Lord doesn't want me to take a drug. Where's my coffee? You get my point. Caffeine works havoc with what's called sleep architecture. There are receptors in the brain for caffeine. Caffeine goes there, blocks these, and your sleep cycle has had it, has absolutely had it. So no caffeine whatsoever.
This has been a podcast presentation of Hillside Four Square Church in Reno, Nevada. You can reach us at web@hillside4.org.